Hi, I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now! For more than 15 years, CJSF 90.1 FM has been bringing Democracy Now! To the greater Vancouver area every weekday at 11 a.m. From New York, this is Democracy Now! As the war in Ukraine approaches its 17th month, we speak to two reporters who've closely looked at the role played by neo-Nazis in the war, from the Azov Battalion in Ukraine to the anti-Putin Russian militia that attacked Russian targets in May.
It's the Azov exception where we go out of our way to celebrate these people, while at the same time, we are screaming that the greatest existential threat to America is white supremacy, where every anti-Semitic remark, everything that could be said, gets immediately amplified, gets immediately, oh, this is horrible, we need to take care of this, while at the same time, we're inviting neo-Nazis to Congress.
But first, we speak to longtime national security reporter William Arkin about the CIA's secret role inside Ukraine and how the agency is shuttling weapons to Kyiv using a, quote, gray fleet of commercial aircraft. His new piece in Newsweek is headlined, "The CIA's Blind Spot About the Ukraine War." All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Donald Trump said Tuesday federal prosecutors have informed him he's the target of a Justice Department criminal investigation into his efforts to overturn the 2020 presidential election. Trump made a similar announcement shortly before Jack Smith filed criminal charges over Trump's mishandling of classified documents. In Florida, the Trump-appointed federal judge overseeing the classified documents case Tuesday appeared skeptical of Trump's request to delay the trial until after the 2024 election. But Judge Aileen Cannon also appeared unlikely to approve a request by federal prosecutors to start the trial by the end of this year. Meanwhile, all nine justices on Georgia's Supreme Court have rejected a bid by Trump's lawyers to block an investigation by Atlanta area prosecutor Fani Willis into efforts by Trump and his allies to overturn the 2020 election. Willis has said she'll announce in August whether charges will be brought in the case. In Michigan, the attorney general there, Dana Nessel, has charged 16 people with felonies for falsely claiming to be presidential electors as they attempted to overturn Trump's 2020 defeat in the state.
As part of the orchestrated plan, we allege that 16 Michigan residents met covertly in the basement of Michigan GOP headquarters and knowingly and of their own volition signed their names to multiple certificates stating that they were the duly elected and qualified electors for president and vice president of the United States of America for the state of Michigan. That was a lie.
One of those charged is Michon Maddock, former co-chair of the Michigan Republican Party, a close ally to Trump and the wife of State Representative Matt Maddock. Michon Maddock previously told a gathering of local Republicans the Trump campaign had directed the fake elector scheme. In China, a series of unrelenting heat waves has created a soaring demand for electricity, leading to unprecedented amounts of coal consumption at China's more than 1,000 coal-fired power plants. This comes after the Chinese government approved a record-breaking 86 gigawatts of new coal-fired power capacity last year. In northern India, floodwaters from unusually heavy rains have pushed the Yamuna River to levels not seen in nearly half a century. On Tuesday, the swollen river was lapping the walls of the famed Taj Mahal, prompting fears the 17th-century monument could become damaged. In Iran, a combination of heat and humidity this week pushed the heat index at the Persian Gulf International Airport to 152 degrees Fahrenheit, with the dew point over 90%. That's close to the limit of what the human body can survive. Meanwhile, Europe is still sweltering. On Tuesday, Rome reached 107 degrees Fahrenheit, or nearly 42 degrees Celsius, while other Italian cities also shattered all-time temperature records. Some hospitals reported their highest number of daily admissions since the worst days of the COVID-19 pandemic. In Greece, the European Union sending water bombers and hundreds of firefighters and soldiers to battle wildfires that erupted around Athens. More wildfires are burning in Spain, Turkey, and Switzerland. Here in the United States, more than 58 million people are enduring triple-digit temperatures this week, with forecasters warning a massive heat dome will remain fixed in southwestern and southern states. In Louisiana, the ACLU filed an emergency plea with a federal court this week, asking for the transfer of children incarcerated at the notorious Angola prison. Advocates say the child prisoners, who are mostly Black, were locked in windowless cells without air conditioning around the clock in the prison's former death row, as the heat index inside Angola topped 130 degrees Fahrenheit. In Texas, officials directed by Republican Governor Greg Abbott to apprehend asylum seekers at the southern border were ordered to push small children and nursing babies back into the Rio Grande to deny water to migrants, even in a sweltering heat. That's according to the Houston Chronicle, which obtained an email written by a Texas Public Safety Department agent calling for policy changes. The trooper, Nicholas Wingate, calls for the removal of barrels wrapped in razor wire placed in the Rio Grande River to stop migrants from crossing the river, writing to his colleagues, quote, "This is nothing but an inhumane trap in high water and low visibility." He describes two incidents from last month where a four-year-old migrant girl and a pregnant woman having a miscarriage were found with severe injuries as they crashed into the barbed wire barrels while crossing the river. The young girl had also passed out from heat exhaustion. Wingate also wrote a migrant mother and one of her children drowned in the Rio Grande in early July and that the woman's other child was never found. Those drownings were never officially reported. In Sudan, the UN reports 200,000 people have been displaced just in the past week as fighting rages between the army and the paramilitary rapid support forces, or RSF. In the 4 months since the conflict erupted, some 2.6 million people have been internally displaced and over 730,000 have fled Sudan. Survivors of the 2003 genocide in Darfur say the targeting of the Masalit people in today's conflict resembles the ethnic cleansing suffered in the region 20 years ago. The International Criminal Court launched an investigation last week into possible war crimes and crimes against humanity in Darfur. This is ICC Prosecutor Karim Khan.
We are, by any analysis, not on the precipice of a human catastrophe, but in the very midst of one. It is occurring. And it's my analysis and my prayer and advice that we must act urgently, collectively, to protect the most vulnerable.
In other news about the International Criminal Court, South Africa has said Russian President Vladimir Putin will not attend this year's BRICS summit. As a member of the ICC, which in March issued an arrest warrant for Putin for war crimes, South Africa would be obligated to arrest him if he entered South Africa. Syrian news outlets are reporting two Syrian soldiers were injured earlier today as Israel's military launched airstrikes around the capital, Damascus. The Syrian Observatory for Human Rights says the assault, which targeted military sites and warehouses operated by Hezbollah fighters from Lebanon, was the 20th such attack by Israel this year inside Syria. In Palestine, the Red Crescent Society says it's begun equipping first responders with helmets and bulletproof vests amidst a surge in attacks on medical workers by Israeli forces and settlers in occupied East Jerusalem and the West Bank. The Red Crescent says there have been nearly 200 incidents targeting staff and ambulances so far this year, more than triple the rate seen over the same period last year. Meanwhile, the Israeli human rights group Peace Now, Shalom Achshav, reports Israel's far-right government has approved 13,000 new housing units in illegal settlements in the West Bank, the highest rate of construction since Peace Now began tracking settlements over a decade ago. In Israel, tens of thousands of protesters flooded the streets of cities nationwide Tuesday for the 28th consecutive week of protests against plans by the far-right government of Benjamin Netanyahu to gut Israel's judiciary. A final vote on the measure could come as soon as early next week. President Biden welcomed Israeli President Isaac Herzog to Washington, D.C. Tuesday, pledging U.S. support to Israel despite rising violence and human rights abuses against Palestinians and the continued expansion of illegal settlements in occupied East Jerusalem and the West Bank. Herzog spoke to reporters outside the White House after meeting President Biden in the Oval Office.
And we discussed thus many issues, including the Iranian nuclear threat and the operations by Hezbollah to flare up the region, as well as our ironclad alliance on security, including the ability to build regional cooperation and move forward on the circle of peace.
President Herzog will address a joint session of Congress today. Some progressive Democrats are planning to boycott the speech to protest Israel's treatment of Palestinians. Among those skipping the address are New York's Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and the first two Muslim women elected to Congress, Minnesota's Ilhan Omar and Michigan's Rashida Tlaib, who's Palestinian-American. On Tuesday, members of the House of Representatives voted 412-9 in favor of a resolution proclaiming Israel's not a racist or apartheid state. The vote was hastily organized after Seattle Congressmember Pramila Jayapal, who heads the Congressional Progressive Caucus, called Israel a racist state in public remarks this weekend. After facing criticism, Congressmember Jayapal later clarified that her comments were directed at the extreme right-wing government of Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. Activists in Western Sahara are calling for solidarity from Palestinian rights groups after Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu Monday formally recognized Morocco's claims of sovereignty over the Northwest African territory. Israel becomes the second country in the world to do so after Donald Trump tweeted U.S. recognition in December 2020. Morocco's occupied Western Sahara since 1975 in defiance of the United Nations and international law. Over the past four decades, thousands of Western Sahara's indigenous people, the Sahrawi, have been tortured, imprisoned, killed, and disappeared while resisting the Moroccan occupation. Speaking with Middle East Eye, Western Sahara-based activist Mohamed El-Baikam said, quote, Morocco relies on the same tools and methods as Israel in suppressing the Palestinians, occupying them, displacing them from their land, robbing them of their wealth, and controlling them, he said. Thailand's constitutional court has suspended lawmaker Pita Limjaroenrat, a top candidate for prime minister, after his liberal Move Forward party garnered the most support in May's national elections. Pita failed to secure the position of prime minister last week after being voted down by the Senate, which was appointed after a military coup in 2014. He's pledged to reform the military and the all-powerful Thai monarchy. He addressed his fellow lawmakers earlier today following a suspension.
I think Thailand is not the same anymore. Ever since May 14th, we have come only halfway from the people's victory, and there is another half to go. As I can no longer perform my duties, I would like to ask fellow members of parliament to continue to look after the people.
And in a victory for criminal justice reform, the Illinois Supreme Court has ruled in favor of legislation abolishing the state's cash bail system. The 5-2 ruling overturned a decision by a lower court from last December, deeming the Pretrial Fairness Act unconstitutional. Illinois judges will no longer require people charged with a crime to post bail in order to be released from jail as they await trial, unless they're considered a threat to the public or likely to flee. The policy is expected to go into effect in September. In a statement, the Illinois Network for Pretrial Justice said, quote, Black people have been disproportionately impacted by wealth-based jailing. Giving people the opportunity to stay in their communities while awaiting trial will enable them to keep their jobs, housing, and custody of their children, making us all safer, they said. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. Coming up, longtime national security reporter William Arkin on the CIA's secret role inside Ukraine and how the agency is shuttling weapons to Kyiv using a, quote, gray fleet of commercial aircraft. His investigation in Newsweek is headlined, The CIA's Blind Spot About the Ukraine War. Back in a minute. Winter Evening by the Ukrainian musician Valentin Silvestrov. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman in New York, joined by Democracy Now! Co-host Juan Gonzalez in Chicago. Hi, Juan.
Hi, Amy, and welcome to all of our listeners and viewers across the country and around the world.
We begin today's show looking at the role of the CIA in the war in Ukraine. A recent cover story of Newsweek revealed the CIA shuttling weapons into Ukraine using a, quote, gray fleet of commercial aircraft that crisscrosses Central and Eastern Europe. CIA personnel are also going into Ukraine on secret missions. According to one source, CIA agents are assisting Ukrainians with new weapons and systems. One senior military intelligence official told Newsweek, quote, the CIA has been operating inside Ukraine under strict rules and with a cap on how many personnel can be in the country at any one time, unquote. The CIA is also using Poland as its clandestine hub to coordinate its operations inside Ukraine. After the September 11th attacks, the CIA also used Poland to house one of its secret black sites where prisoners were tortured. We're joined now by William Arkin, senior editor at Newsweek. His investigation for the magazine is headlined The CIA's Blind Spot About the Ukraine War. Today, William Arkin is joining us from Sweden. He's a prize-winning national security reporter. His books include Top Secret America, The Rise of the New American Security State. Bill Arkin, welcome back to Democracy Now! It's great to have you with us. Why don't you start off by telling us, in this many-month investigation, what you did, what surprised you most? And don't speak in sound bites.
Thank you, Amy, for having me on again. You know, I worked on this question of what the role of the CIA was in Ukraine, and I wanted to know particularly whether or not all of the Hollywood rumors surrounding the agency, its possible involvement in the attack on the Nord Stream pipelines, its possible involvement in other sabotage attacks inside Russia, a lot of the news that I was hearing about the presence of the CIA on the ground and its covert assistance. I wanted to know how much of it was true, and I went down this path to try to get to the truth. What I came up with most importantly, and really this is most importantly, is that the CIA is an intelligence agency. And so its number one mission in Ukraine is to collect intelligence not just on what the Russians are doing, but also on what the Ukrainians are doing. And that's the biggest blind spot, as I identified, which is that the United States knows as little about what Zelensky is up to and what he's thinking and what his views are about the future as it does about Vladimir Putin and his future plans and intentions. And so this might come as a surprise to some people, but as my sources explained it to me, the reality is that Ukraine is not an ally of the United States. We have no treaty obligations towards Ukraine. And the United States is not at war with Russia. So this is a particularly unique battlefield in which the CIA is playing an outsized role. But it is playing an outsized role because the Biden administration has been firm in saying that the U.S. military will not be involved in any direct way in the fighting or on the battlefield or indeed inside Ukraine. So you have the situation where the the CIA's primary mission, which is to figure out what it is that the Russians and the Ukrainians are doing, as well as now its augmented mission, which is to play a greater role in the provision of arms to Ukraine, a greater role in counterintelligence, a greater role in corralling all of the neighbor states to Ukraine so that they stay firmly engaged in the war, some countries of which the domestic population is not as enthusiastic about war with Russia as is, say, for instance, Poland, that this role really stretches the CIA quite thin in terms of what it's doing, but also it's got its hand in a little bit of everything. And I would say that I would give it low marks on understanding the intentions of Putin or Zelensky, very high marks on understanding what's going on in the battlefield. But the most high marks are in moving the billions of dollars worth of weapons that the United States and NATO has pledged to Kyiv.
But now, William Arkin, the CIA is no stranger to Ukraine. Clearly, in the post-World War II period, it was involved in developing right-wing groups within Ukraine that were opposing the Soviet Union, a lot of them former neo-Nazis. And as you write, the CIA has been central to the war, this war, even before it began, when Biden tapped Director William Burns as his global troubleshooter. Could you talk about Burns's role and this historic connection between the CIA and groups in Ukraine?
Well, when Joe Biden became president, he appointed a number of his close associates, Antony Blinken and Jake Sullivan, to be his main national security actors. But the person that was appointed to be the director of the CIA, former ambassador to Russia, William Burns, and a foreign service officer in his career, was somebody who was much more considered to be the senior statesman of the administration, if you will, the person with the most experience. And so when Russia invaded Ukraine in February 2022, it was no surprise that Burns became the central figure in this war, and that he had both the superior knowledge of Putin and of Russia, but also he had a long career specializing in Eastern Europe. So when he was appointed, the Biden administration's back channel negotiator, diplomat, and main spy, it fell to him to handle relations with Kyiv. Remember, the U.S. embassy was closed for a long time. It fell to the CIA to handle the clandestine relations that existed with Poland and other countries, relationships which had been built up since 9/11 and since even the end of the Cold War. So the CIA has played an extremely important role in the modern era. And I would say that the legacy of what the CIA may have done in the Soviet era just is not represented by those who work in the CIA today, nor is it part of what the CIA thinks its main purpose is.
And in terms of why the Biden administration has not insisted on more openness on the part of Ukraine's government, given the enormous amount of aid that the U.S. is giving, why hasn't it pressed President Zelensky to be more forthcoming about what Ukraine is doing?
Well, I think that the CIA and the U.S. government has pressed the Ukrainians. It doesn't necessarily mean that they have full control over them. The reality is that the U.S.'s main objective and the Biden administration's supreme objective has always been to see that the war not be escalated, that the United States not be put into a situation where it's fighting against Russia directly. And part of that was to urge Ukraine not to attack Russia, not to attack Belarus, where Russian forces were deployed. And that really pretty much worked up until about September or October of last year, first when the Nord Stream bombings occurred, and then second when the attack on the Kerch Bridge occurred, in which case the United States, the U.S. intelligence, believed that Ukraine was behind both of them. And And though it believed that Ukrainian factions were behind both of those attacks, it wasn't altogether clear to the CIA that Zelensky himself had foreknowledge or even had been read in on those operations, because Zelensky's power himself, those powers are himself limited inside Ukraine. And so the CIA might have put a lot of pressure on Zelensky and his government in order to be more transparent or to deal with corruption or to deal with accountability. But it's not altogether clear that Zelensky has full control over the Ukrainian military or the Ukrainian secret services, nor is it necessarily the case that the United States is in a position to really exert much leverage against Ukraine at this point. It's like too big to fail that the United States has invested so much in the Ukraine war that it can't really credibly say to Zelensky, if you don't do X, we're going to stop supplying you with arms. It's just not a tenable policy anymore. So the CIA represents these many interests, the interest not to escalate with Russia, the interest not to have Russia resort to the use of nuclear weapons, trying to understand what Putin's position and Putin's thinking is. But at the same time, it struggles with the question of whether or not it understands well enough what it is that Ukraine wants, and also what it is that Ukraine will accept beyond its public rhetoric in trying to end the war.
You mentioned William Burns, now head of the CIA, very interesting key figure, former ambassador to Russia. And you talked about how he went to Russia before the war. He's also the one who for years warned against the expansion of NATO, saying it's going to provoke Russia. So you talk about what the U.S. understands about Ukraine. What does the U.S. understand about Russia right now and working with Russia before Russia invaded?
Well, I'm afraid that the Biden administration has really squandered the possibility of being a third actor in this war. The United States has aligned itself 100% with Ukraine. And as a result of that, I don't see much movement or much interest even on the part of the U.S. government in Washington to be a third party, to actually be a negotiator, to find a peaceful resolution. So really, no one is playing that role. The United Nations is not playing that role. Sweden is not playing that role anymore now that it aspires to be a member of NATO. There is no neutral party that really is playing the role of trying to end the conflict between the two parties, who are essentially stalled right now in combat, where there's not really much movement on either the side, but the killing continues. So it was the case that in the minds of Russia, the expansion of NATO was provocative and may, in the theory of national security, been a strategic threat to Russia. And it is probably the case that when history is written, we will say that NATO was a little bit too greedy in its zeal to expand into Eastern Europe. But the reality is that that doesn't excuse the Russian invasion, not in 2014 nor in 2022. And the reality for the CIA is that they need to understand what Putin's intentions are, not only to understand the implications of Ukraine's actions, particularly its increasing actions in Crimea and across the border in Russia, but also to understand what it is that Putin will settle for as part of a settlement, and also what it is that Zelensky will settle for. So it's a tricky situation where I don't really have a lot of confidence that the CIA is fully on top of what either of these two leaders think.
William Arkin, I wanted to double back to a comment you just made a few moments ago in terms of Ukraine, that you said that it's not clear that President Zelensky is fully in charge of his military. Do your sources indicate to you what the CIA believes? Who are the other potential forces that might have some control over the military?
Well, in the structure of the Ukrainian government, you have the presidency and the office of the president. It's a rather new democratic institution, so it only has so much power. And during a war, that power is somewhat diminished. Then there's the military itself and its commander-in-chief, who is the most powerful actor in Ukrainian society today. But you also have the National Guard, and you have Ukrainian intelligence, and you have the Ukrainian secret agencies, including secret special operations forces. And it's not clear who indeed is in charge of all of them. My guess is that the commander-in-chief of the Ukrainian armed forces is nominally in charge. But there's also a desire, which my sources particularly highlight,